Hello and welcome to episode 99 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's never-ending search for the answer to that question, what is it about this game? Rod Murray's my name and I'm joined on the line by my colleague John Huggan to introduce an episode which frankly has been on my bucket list for quite some time. Huggy, welcome. It's hard to imagine a golfer alive who isn't familiar with the voice of Dottie Pepper, but her TV work is just a small part of what's been a fabulous career. How do you know her and when did you first encounter her?
Well, I first came across, obviously, top player. I'm not sure that we were the best of friends at the beginning, but we've our friendship has certainly grown over the years. She was very good about doing this podcast. We actually recorded it in the Airbnb. It was a kind of shed that I was staying in. It was literally over the wall from the Marine Hotel in North Berwick, where she was staying for the Scottish Open. And the house that was once owned by Katrina Matthew. And all we did, Dottie just kind of hopped over the wall and we recorded it in the little building that was paid for by Katrina. She told me later that she put the bathroom in. So very nice it was too.
See these backstories, Huggy. People never get to see the glamorous side of podcasting.
it's always best to go off at tangents, I always think.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You mentioned, of course, there, European and American Solheim Cup, Dottie Pepper. Natural enemies, I would think. Was that the source of your early not getting along so well?
Well, no, we didn't not get along. We just sort of, you know, there was a kind of, I'm not sure if she even was aware of me at that point. But I've known her now for years, and her husband too, lovely guy, very very bright guy. He's, I'm not sure, did he go to Oxford or Cambridge? It's one of the two. He'd love to forgive me on that. He'll laugh when I don't know which one it is. But Dottie's, as you say, she's terrific on the television, one of my favorites for, you know, the on-course part of the deal. The one frustration is that she doesn't get to say very much.
No.
Because it's all very, you know, bang, bang, bang. As you know, when you're on the course, it's a 5-iron, the wind's coming from the right and, you know, the pin's back left or whatever, you know.
She's a fabulous analyst. One of the things I've always liked about Dottie Huggy, and this is probably sounds like a silly thing to say, but she's a proper golfer, isn't she? I remember she appeared on one of our other podcasts at one point, and I distinctly remember her saying that she hates the term grow the game. And I think people who love the game will understand that, won't they?
Yeah. She's just on the ball with most things. I mean, I can't think that, you know, she and I agree on absolutely everything, but it's just about everything. I spent a lot of time during this podcast nodding my head at what she was saying, which is sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I think on these things.
That's exactly right. Remind me of the incident I'm sure she was involved in, Huggy, at the Solheim Cup one year. There was one of those clowns you punch that goes down and comes back up. Somebody's face, was it Dottie's face on it in the European room or was it Annika's face on it in the US room? I can't remember.
It was Dottie's. I think it was at Muirfield Village, and they had a kind of pinata type thing. You know those things that you take a baseball bat to.
Yes.
And I think the story goes that Dottie's face was on there, and the team just took turns at beating hell out of it, which I think was probably the most backhanded compliment you could ever get. I mean, she was the sort of number one on the American team for certainly in match play at that point.
Yeah, she would have been delighted had she found out about it at the time. I'm sure that she was living rent-free inside their heads, as the kids like to say. Lots of people only know her as a TV analyst, Huggy. There's a lot of young people in the world these days. Much more than that, isn't she? We've alluded to it there. Fabulous Solheim Cup player, major winner, and a force on the LPGA Tour for the best part of a decade and a half.
She was part of a great generation of players, you know, Julie Inkster, Betsy King, Patty Sheehan, Pat Bradley, all that group, and she won majors playing against that lot. No mean feat. You know, she plays it down, like, you know, she's modest with it, but my goodness, she was a proper player. I mean, she in the sense that there was a lot of shots in her bag. She didn't just play the same shot all the time, but the game was slightly different back then, certainly, but my goodness, she was fun to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Huggy, we're going to let you go because I know that you need to get off and have something too. It's been great of you to take some time. Really, I'm really looking forward to listening to this one. I've had a sneak peek, but I think the listeners will enjoy it as well. Thanks for joining us today, mate.
My pleasure. Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time, a very special guest in a very unique location. I guess you'd tell people where we're actually sitting, in a small cabin next to the Marine Hotel in North Berwick, just over the wall from the 16th green on the golf course. And it's raining, of course. But welcome, Doddy Pepper. We always start with the same question. What was or is the thing about golf for you?
For me, it was something I could do either from the start with my grandmother, but I could go by myself. Right. I didn't have to have somebody on the other side of the net. Mm-hmm. To return a ball or play at the other end of a court or whatever it was. But it was also, I think, as I've come to even appreciate more, it doesn't care who the heck you are. It's you and the golf ball. Yeah. And it doesn't know if you're male, female, whether you can play a lick or not. It just, it goes.
Plus, I'm guessing there wasn't a whole lot of other females wanting to play as much golf as you did, was there?
No. In high school, there was one other girl in our council that played golf. Right. That was it. So I played on the boys' team. She played on the boys' team. We'd meet when our squads met against each other. But no, it was definitely not grab your best pal, gal pal, and go play golf.
Right, And was your enthusiasm, like it sounds, right from day one? I mean,
pretty much. I skied all winter. But my parents tell the story of an 11 or 12-year-old coming home and saying, well, I'm gonna play professional golf. I'm going to be really good at this. And they said, yeah, right.
Yeah. And when did it become clear that there was some talent there then? Because everybody wants to do that.
Of course. Yeah. You play with your dad and the parent-child or, I guess when I started playing well in little junior tournaments, and I had to play, I mean, there weren't that many of those junior tournaments anyway. But you end up playing against the older ladies in the club and having to give them shots and beating them anyway. I guess that was probably a sign.
I'm sure you were very popular.
They loved me.
And where did it go then? I mean, how you got to get into competitive golf, and I'm guessing it's just harder.
It was much harder for a girl. Just to find tournaments. Period. Yeah. So I played on a boys' team in high school. I played on our boys' club team because there just weren't any other girls that were playing. So you played wherever the competition was, and you learned. For me, because you didn't play off a different set of tees, you learned how to grind it out. Mm-hmm. I physically couldn't hit it as far, but you figure out how to get the ball in the hole and be competitive.
And how welcome were you at this point with the boys?
The boys, I never had a problem at all in high school. Not one bit. I had very supportive teammates, a couple of which I still run into in town.
Because we're not going to give you your age away, Dottie. But
I'll be 58.
We're going back,
I graduated from high school in 83, so there you go.
The world of golf wasn't quite as enlightened
No. Fortunately, I did have high school athletic administrators that said, well, there's no girls' team for her to play on, so why not?
Yeah. And you must have gotten some pleasure from that secretly, did you?
I mean,
the fact that you could beat the boys.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I would love that. And sort of how good were you, running through sort of teenage years? I mean, handicap-wise, tournament-wise, what were you winning?
I wouldn't say, I was breaking 80 on a regular basis until I was probably in the seventh grade.
What age is that?
So that's...
For non-Americans?
For non-Americans, that's 12.
Right, okay. Well, that's still pretty sort of prodigious, at the age of 12, breaking 80, I would say. Because, I mean, you're not very big now, so I can't imagine. You must have been quite small then.
I was actually about this size. Okay. I grew early, and then I stopped. But, I don't know, you played wherever you could, and you read the newspapers, and you saw scores, and every once in a while you get to watch a little bit of golf on television and know what the kind of what the standard was and tried to do your best to do that. But I was encouraged to do whatever I possibly could. Mm-hmm. And, there weren't any ceilings put on it. But, I mean, in high school, by the time I was a senior, I went to the state championship. 98 guys and me.
Really?
At Cornell University, so... Yeah, that was the pinnacle. And still, it wasn't until 4 years ago now that we had a Section 2 in the area we live in now, where I grew up, that had a state qualifier, so the girls could get to the state championship. There was a state championship, but in our area, we didn't have the tournament required to get to that championship. So I qualified against the boys.
Did you ever feel any discouragement internally, just to is this worth batting my head against this wall, or did it even occur to you?
It didn't occur to me because that's just what it was, and ended up sadly, it was nearly 40 years later before it changed. And now the girl who got through because of our championship in place now won both the state championship individually for the second straight year, right, and her team won the championship, which, again, 4 years ago, there wasn't even that opportunity. Yeah. So they've taken the opportunity that a lot of people got behind, whether it was through writing or through a network of just people who are making noise about it. And not only did they go play, they won.
I wasn't going to get to this as quickly as I, but the order of thing always changes when I do these things. But how do you think golf's doing in its relationship with women? I mean, obviously things are getting better and are a lot better, but I'm still thinking we've got a fair bit, fair ways to go. There's on that front.
Always more to go, but I think it has come so far in the last, especially 10 years or so, 12 years, big changes. And I think too, it's really important to separate professional golf from the game of golf.
Yes.
It's hugely important. And you look about the numbers of women and girls playing the game now. They were a big post-COVID, during COVID, push, because it was something everybody could do, and you could do together. And I think it's the job of people that are in and around the game that appreciate the game to continue that momentum. And I'm seeing that happen. The greatest growth in the game is in that space.
Well, who would have thought that, you know, we're sitting here about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles, 5 miles from your field, who've now got, you know, I think 20-odd
correct,
you know, women members.
Correct. And they're international members.
Yeah.
They're not, they have the best of the network of golf is now in part of and an active part of the membership at Muirfield.
Yeah, I mean, on the subject of single sex clubs, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I've never really had a problem with a single sex club.
Nor I.
Per se, I mean, a normal, if you can, in inverted commas. I mean, if they want to be private and do their own thing, as long as they're not getting any tax breaks or anything like that, you know, good on you. But the rules are slightly different for, certainly for the RNA. Who make the rules for the game, they can't be doing that and not have women involved. Right. And equally, Muirfield can't be getting an Open Championship.
That's right.
If there are no women.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways. Yeah,
that's right. The rules change if you go public.
That's exactly right. And it should be. But I don't harbor it against anybody who has a private single sex club.
It's not for me, but who am I to say
you can't do it? I think I'm hearing that the machinations are underway again for an all-women's club back in the United States. Fine. You just can't have a national championship there.
That's right. Yeah. So we're making progress. Where are we on the scale, though? I mean, are you happy with the way it's going? I mean,
I was, in today's terminology, I would call it trending.
Right, okay.
And that's, everything had to start from a trend, whether it was being more accepted of junior golfers. And it's not just in golf, it's every other sport. I mean, think about even the Olympics. There are some sports where women weren't allowed to compete, or some sports that weren't included at all.
Yeah,
and those are starting to change.
Yeah, I do think it, you know, if we can talk about the professional game for a bit, we're never going to see. I don't think, or never say never, but it's going to be incredibly exceptional if a woman ever becomes competitive in the men's game, simply because of the strength, power.
Absolutely. That's just physiological.
Yeah.
And that's what we've seen it from when we were playing to now, and the emphasis on speed and speed training.
Yes.
Yeah. It's nothing like what we had. And we know more about how the body responds, how the body needs to recover, than we did even a decade ago.
Yeah.
So, no, I think that would be definitely the exception.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about 20 years now since Annika played at Colonial.
At Colonial, and you think about Michelle Wee, we ran a piece in when she played at John Deere and reached the 17th green in two. And oddly enough, the thing that she remembers was not that she reached it in two, but that she missed the eagle putt.
Right, so, of course.
Yeah. But those are definitely the exceptions, and like you said, never say never.
Yeah, I mean, I had mixed feelings about that Annika thing back then. I mean, how did you feel about it? I mean, Vijay Singh stuck his head up and you know, and became the, you know, poster boy for misogyny, if you like. But I didn't, that wasn't how I felt about it. I just thought This is more about promoting Anika than it is promoting. It
totally was a brand experiment.
Yeah.
And fine. I just didn't feel like it needed to be. She needed to pick a golf course that she thought she could be competitive on, have a chance to at least play four rounds. What I didn't love, and I wasn't alone, was that she picked a week that was opposite a tournament that had been so good to the LPGA for so long, that being the Corning Classic. Yeah. But to her credit, she came back to Corning the next year and won the golf tournament.
Well, fair enough. Yeah, yeah. So, how do you think, because we're going down this path now, I mean, this is how my mind goes. How do you think the standard compares now with when you were at your peak in the women's game, I'm talking?
I think the quality of play is a little deeper. And I don't think the top is any
the best ones any are not better. Better.
No, they're not better. Right. But the talent pool goes deeper. Right. And I think if you ask players that were a decade ahead of us, they would have probably said the same thing. The scores really aren't all that much better. Yeah. But there are more people, and it shows that if you go through the list, more people winning golf tournaments, and the depth, it's definitely better.
The scoring's about the same. Are the courses being set up the same way now as they were when you were playing? Because the men, the things they have to do to the golf courses now to keep the scoring within reasonable parameters is almost offensive.
The women run this different sort of, why will people watch? Is it because of quality of golf? Is it because of low scores? Is it watching great athletes do their best thing? What I don't love about the LPGA setup is that there is what I call forced equity, and that's it's been told by the committee to have the golf course set up so that every player in the field can reach one of the par fives every day.
Really?
I don't love that.
No.
In fact, I really don't like it at all.
Yeah.
I think so what you're doing is you're messing with par. I mean, and not that you need to be enamored with par either, because the goal is just to get it into the hole in as few strokes as possible. But when you start messing around with that and messing around with setups to make scores look good so that people catch it, so people tune in, to me, you're doctoring the meritocracy of the system.
It's almost like clickbait, isn't
correct.
It?
Correct.
Sexy headlines that, you know, you actually start to read the story. That drives me nuts.
You get to paragraph three and you're like, why did I waste my time?
Exactly. Yeah, this story's got nothing to do with the headline.
Correct.
Yeah.
If all our golf talk has you itching for a round, check out the Golf Now app. Easily book social golf online at hundreds of courses across Australia, including some of Golf Australia's top 100 tracks. Download the free app or visit golfnow.com.au today.
So, the pathway that the LPGA is on, again, we're going to talk about Liv and Saudis and all the rest of it later on, but it seems to me, Katrina Matthew actually said this to me. I hope she doesn't mind me quoting her. But she said to me quite a long time ago now that if the Saudis came with the money to the LPGA and said, you know, the LPGA would have to cave, because if they didn't, the Saudis would just buy all the players.
Correct. No, she's absolutely correct. They wouldn't have had the reserve to even last as long as men's golf did against that against that system.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about all that? I mean, I think, you know, just for me, my opinion for in here, but Jay Monahan's biggest mistake, I think, was making it a moral issue. More than, you know, because you can change your mind on things, but you can never really change your morals. You're kind of stuck with them.
Yeah.
And he kind of went down that path too far to come back, well, if you like. But I don't know that. I don't know what you think.
The first bit that we were all aware of and would agree that if it was purely about money, no one could withstand that push. If it was about morals, then we have higher ground to stand on. I hate what happened, that all of a sudden that switch was flipped, because I felt coming out of last year at the Canadian Open, where when it was said that you as a PGA Tour player, you never had to apologize for playing this tour and in the ground, and that I still think is just kind of tragic. But I also, and I, you know, look, we don't know all the machinations behind it, and maybe we don't need to, maybe we never will. But what I think golf lost, especially in the last, not to make this non-evergreen, but since June 6th, is a little bit of its, kind of its innocence. And the fact that it stands as one of those sports where you call a penalty on yourself. When it's bad, it's, yeah, when it's bad.
Yeah.
When it's good, it's really good. But I think the innocence of golf kind of went by the wayside, and we became a lot like other sports.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, I mean, but I mean, the women, you know, if anybody's going to stand on a moral platform,
no question, it would
be the women, given what goes on in Saudi Arabia.
No question.
But it's an impossible situation, isn't it? I mean, in terms of, certainly if you look at it purely as a financial thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, Norman getting involved was 30 plus years of vengeance.
Yeah.
Feeling like his idea was stolen and then dissed. But I also think at the root of all of it is greed on everybody's behalf. It was never enough for the players. It was never enough for the tours. It was never enough for anyone. And when there's more money that's going to be flowing in, then everybody's eyes brighten up. And how can we have a part of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're 2 days away from the announcement that the Open next week, we're 1 week away from the Open at Hoylake.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a $3 million first prize from a $16.5 million US dollar purse. I'm intrigued by this, and I don't know how you think about it. That why are they doing that? Is there any player worth their salt going to say, "Ah, I'm not going to play in the Open this year because the money's not big enough"?
I'm totally with you.
I mean, what are they doing?
I'm with you, and I feel like they feel like they're going to be left behind, and I just think the majors have an opportunity to stand even clearer of all of this, and it's. Every major champion that you speak to, it was about the journey, it was about the trophy, and it wasn't about what showed up in their bank account.
Yeah, I mean, when you won your majors, did you know what the first prize was?
Couldn't even have told you.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have taken a whole lot to figure it out because it's generally, because the women's tour owns, they are their majors,
yeah,
but it's 15% of whatever the total purse was. But I couldn't have told you what the purse was.
No.
That was just, you know, the standard breakdown.
And that was back when you weren't earning the money that they earn now.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, last week, Women's Open, the winner walked away with $2 million. That was, let's see, more than 20% of my total earnings in my career. Well. So it's all very, very relative, but I guarantee you that the winner thinks about having that trophy, a part of your soul, your legacy as a major champion, you'll always be in that quote unquote club, yeah, and not what happens. It may change your life in a material way because of what that paycheck is, yeah, but that goes away too.
Yeah.
That's short lived at best.
Yeah. How do you look back? We're shifting gears yet again. I mean, mine's a load,
I've just messed you up.
No, it's fine. I mean, these things are better when they just go wherever, mm-hmm, they go. But how do you look back on your career? Do you against par, say? Were you walk away even par, or were you under par, or were you over par? How did you feel about it when you finished?
I probably left a few opportunities on the table, and but overall, if you'd have told me when I started that I would have played 17 years, I would have thought, that's a long time.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't think in relative terms, I don't think it's crazy long. But I did win 17 times, so there was an amazing consistency to it. Mm-hmm. Played all over the world, won all over the world. I played at a time when women's golf had a new flashpoint in the Solheim Cup.
Yep.
So it became a significant time in women's golf.
You enjoyed the Solheim Cup, didn't you?
Just a little.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Just a little. Yeah. I enjoyed covering it as an announcer. I just, it was an opportunity you didn't have. You didn't have many opportunities, yeah, to play as a,
well,
team,
yeah,
but in an individual sport.
For people who are not quite as familiar as I am with the way you played, I mean, I think the word intense was invented for you. Is that fair?
Maybe there was a face attached to it for the first time. I didn't know how to do anything, and I still don't. Kind of half-assed.
Right.
And preparation and being in the tournament moment, it was very hard for me to be still water, as a lot of sports psychologists would say. People operate in this eddy pool that really doesn't move much, and I wasn't that.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you basically don't play anymore.
I don't.
And that level, I mean, which takes me back to the intensity thing, and my mutual person, we both know, Curtis Strange, mm-hmm. is exactly the same
thing.
He was just as intense as mm-hmm. you were. Exact, you know, you were like mirror images of each other, and he hardly plays at all now as well. I think
hardly
is
plays
it
at all.
The theory being, of course, that you've only got so much in the tank, and once it's empty, that's it.
And I think too that you, and definitely to that point. We had certain standards that you knew what your potential was,
yeah, and you needed to work at a lesser level,
right? And you need to work hard to keep that up. But I think in my case, and in Curtis's as well, you gave up a lot of things to be the best. And you get to some point in your life, and you realize that now I'm going to go do those things.
Yeah,
and that's what I do. My intensity is just shifted into other places.
Yeah. You are still that intense person.
I am.
So did you walk away, you know, happy enough? I mean, when you stopped, any regrets?
There was no. Oh, yeah. I think you're not human if you don't have regrets. But I had a wonderful channel for that energy and for that competitiveness and for the. So now instead of trying to play a perfect round of golf, which as we know doesn't really exist. You try to be a part of a team that puts on a perfect broadcast, which again probably doesn't exist because you have so many moving parts and every day is always different. But you always there's that pinnacle sitting up there that you're always trying to get to the top of that hill.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm still trying to get you to drag you back to the playing days and expand a bit more on what drove you. What where did that intensity come from?
Oh,
you've got the greatest name for it, Pepper.
Right? Yeah. Well, I didn't have anything to do with that. That was my dad, but I think that's where I got my intensity from because he played professional baseball.
Right.
And when he wasn't playing baseball anymore, golf was his outlet, golf and skiing. So to take that down a skiing route, I would, another thing I could do by myself. I didn't have to have, I didn't mind being by myself. I still don't mind being by myself. I remember probably 7 or 8 years ago, I go over to Stratton Mountain, which is maybe an hour and a half from where we live, place that I won on the LPGA tour. I skied there as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, making my way down the mountain, making these good turns. Well, my dad was also a ski instructor during the winter when he left baseball. And this man, an instructor on the hill, stopped me and he said, "Those are some really good turns." And I said, "Well, my dad was a pain in the ass."
Right. Yeah,
and if you're going to do something, you do it the right way. Yeah, so there even, 40 years later, there was still an intensity to how I was making proper turns.
So what handicap are you as a skier?
I'm scratch.
Yeah. It's impressive.
Yeah.
I can barely get down.
And the same thing. So where we live now, one of the greatest mountains in Olympic history, certainly at Whiteface, is less than 2 hours away. So up I go to Whiteface. But I'd felt like that the last time I'd been to Whiteface, the mountain owned me a little bit. So I sought out an instructor and we went and skied for a couple
Even
of hours.
Now?
Absolutely.
Wow. Right. Yeah. That is intense.
Yeah. It was good though. And I think he enjoyed it because he really, it was more of a fine tuning and more of an appreciation of how to use that mountain to your advantage. And I think that would be like somebody's reaching out to, come watch me hit a few golf balls.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, back at the golf, the era that you played in, and when you were at the top of your game, was a particularly strong era for certainly for American golf. I mean, mm-hmm. you can rattle off Lopez, Daniel, Malin, all those names, Sheehan. There was a whole bunch
Bradley,
of them.
On and on.
Yeah.
But even, to put European women in there, Laura Davies was arguably at her height and moving up. I mean, she won at Plainfield in 87. Mm-hmm. I had just turned pro. So wake up. This isn't just an American game.
Yeah.
Ayako Okamoto was in that same vein. So played against some of the best players to really have ever played the women's game.
Who were the best ones? Who did the one? Who was the one that you didn't fancy?
There's always one.
Even Nicholas used to say about Trevino.
Yeah. Somebody who was never going to back down was Pat Bradley, ever. And I still, covering Keegan, we still tell stories sitting, talking on the range, talking about his Aunt Pat. And I talked to her the Sunday morning before he won at Travelers. And she was still the same. But for someone who was as steely a competitor and who was always a little bit insecure about her preparation, she was always nervous Nelly a little bit. But if you put her back against the wall, she was going to deliver. And that was even her getting ready to watch Keegan that afternoon. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm sitting here. She said, I'm pacing. She said, I know I'm going to be on the edge of my chair. I'm going to have, and I said, your visor pulled down. Because when Pat Bradley pulled her visor down, you knew she meant it. Yeah. She was a pretty special kind of competitor.
Yeah. I always thought Lopez was slightly more important because her profile, public profile, went higher than the other ones. Betsy King, the other.
She smiled a lot more than everybody did, but yeah. The commissioner, I mean, the LPGA needed a face.
Yeah.
And when Lopez came on the scene in the mid 70s, she delivered, late 70s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Winning five straight times as a rookie.
Yeah.
And winning in important markets that were on the LPGA's schedule for a long time, it became a part of that tour's legacy.
Tell me about your major wins. How do you look back on them?
90s.
Does it seem like you're talking about a different person these days?
No.
The trivial
really.
Level I played at golf, I think it's a different person. No, it's not me anymore.
No, not really. 92 winning at Dyna was. It was kind of finally getting over the edge because I'd played so well in 91. I think I was third or fourth on the money list and didn't win a golf tournament.
Really? Wow.
So it was just week after week after week after week, and came into that part of the early part of 92 playing very well. So it was a matter of time, but when's that time? And I had won in early on in 89, which was my second year on tour. I won again in 90. So that's sort of stamps your first as not an accident. Mm. But then when you play so well for the whole next year and don't win, wonder what the heck's going on. But that same year Meg Mallon won two major championships. And I was right there with her, especially for the Women's Open. So I think that was just kind of a stamp of preparation. 99 was definitely a rededication over that winter to training and being ready to go. It was the first year I'd spent in Florida in a long time, really preparing, and had worked with a trainer and got my clubs tweaked just right. Right. Jack Wilcotti did an amazing job. I remember I was telling David the story about it yesterday when we went in.
David being my husband.
Yes. And a very nice player on his own right, yes, but set of golf clubs that were not where they needed to be.
No one is more enthusiastic about golf than your husband.
No, he's not. Yeah. There's nobody is. And just about, not professional golf, but golf in general. But working with Wilcotti to get a set of golf clubs that fit properly for me. My clubs were too upright. Hitting these shots off the toe, knew I was swinging well, go in and get a proper set of golf clubs matched up to you and how, what a difference it could make. But it was that week that I thought I was a very weak pitcher of the golf ball. I drove the ball poorly that week. I drove it a long way, but I drove it poorly as far as accuracy goes. I pitched the ball like a genius. Yeah. So when I missed, it was not that big of a deal. Yeah. And I hold the putts that I had to hold. So that was kind of honestly, a magical week. Mm. I didn't even hit many stoplights on the way to the golf course that week.
No, I'll bet. The year that you mentioned there that you were third on the money list and didn't win,
mm-hmm.
that kind of feeds into a little theory of mine, is that I think that consistency at the level you're talking about is the most overrated quality that you can have. I mean, nobody remembered how well you played that year, I bet, because you didn't win.
Right.
People only remember wins. I would rather, I mean, Sandy Lyle and Seve went down this path as well. I never understood why, because surely at the start of the year, if somebody said, right, you can either win five times and miss every other cut, or you can be seventh every week. I mean, it doesn't seem to me like there's much of a choice there. So I don't get this consistency thing. You know, how do you?
Well, a part of it though is you don't want to be teeing it up on Saturday or Sunday having. Well, I guess Saturday doesn't really, because if you have a great round, there are a few Saturdays that a great round won't go somewhere to get you into yeah. within a chance on yeah. Sunday. I had never liked teeing it up on Sunday. We didn't have some chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be hard to get up for that.
Yes, yeah. exactly. So putting that same level of intensity in there. But if you don't put that same level of intensity in there, you can't just switch that on and off. Mm-hmm. So you need to apply yourself every day. But yeah, people remember wins, but you're also talking about professional golf too, where you need a paycheck.
Yeah, but
so there's a balance there.
You can't tell me, I can't tell you how many top tens Jack Nicklaus had in his career.
Oh, he didn't care. And Curtis Strange will tell you. Yeah. Nobody remembers who finished the second. No.
Which that's again true. Feeds into this consistency thing intrigues me. And they'll still talk about it. You still hear players, I want to be more consistent. Why? Just hit home runs.
Yeah, I think it wears on your psyche, though. Is this the week that I have it, or is this the week I completely lose it?
Yeah, but, and again, there's the old cliche, which you'll have heard a million times, is that you win 90% of your money in 10% of your tournaments. Again, that no feeds question. Into the fact, home runs.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, yep. I don't get it. You know.
But I think you have to have that consistent pool of results to when the pressure comes on and you have a chance to win to yeah. knock it over the edge.
Yeah, but you've either got that or you don't. You can't. I don't think you can manufacture that. That was
No, you can't manufacture it, but I think you have to have you pull on stores of success.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but then there's nothing like winning.
No. What did Tiger say? Winning takes care of everything.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, and you know, the technology thing this week with Rory with his Persimmon driver, the thought went through my mind was, if Tiger had been playing with the old equipment, then he would never have lost. He would have won every tournament.
Wouldn't that have been something?
Yeah. I mean, the technology thing, people are probably sick of me banging on about this, but I really think that at the top level, the game has been diminished by this. And certainly the biggest victims being the golf courses, but the average driver now on tour, and it probably is the same in the women's game, is now much closer to the best driver than they were back in the day when driving was actually quite difficult.
No question. Marginal shots aren't magnified the way they were with the technology of the game that we grew up with. I mean, I was, as you were, in that era where I grew up with a wooden driver, and it was just as I was getting into college that semi-decent metal woods came onto the scene. And it wasn't just the driver heads. I mean, the shafts changed so much.
Yeah, that's right.
We started to know a lot more about, and the golf balls changed a lot. Mm-hmm. I think it would not have been a fair fight.
No.
Had Tiger had to play with that equipment, he was that far superior.
Yeah. Well, there was the famous quote from Phil saying that Tiger's playing with
inferior equipment.
And he was. It was true.
Still beating the tar out of everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, do you know, again, I descend into old fuddy-duddy-ism with this, but I mean, I do lament the fact that the game at the top level is no. Again, I use this line all the time, but nobody plays like Trevino or Seve.
Right.
So how can it be better?
Right. I'm with you. It's become very homogenized.
Yes.
Early in the 90s, Colleen Walker won the Vare Trophy, and it was the first time that someone with a game improvement set of golf clubs had won the Vare Trophy. Right. And to me, it was a little tainted. Because I was an old school forged that great strikes were rewarded. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about missing it okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that to me was a little bit of a, kind of cringeworthy.
The women's game gone the same way? I mean, how would the women's game look if they banned hybrids?
I was just going to go down that road. It would be ugly. Mm. As Billy Kratzer said, a bouquet of hybrids.
Yeah.
It would be I carried a 2-iron until, gosh, at least 98. And I fought like hell not to have a hybrid in there because that was it was a hooking spoon. It just was up there floating around somewhere.
But certainly in the men's game, and I use Nicholas Kolsatz, a friend of this, a friend of mine who's a magnificent long iron player.
Yes,
and absolutely. Gets no benefit from it whatsoever.
That's right. It's a, it's homogenized. It's just all just sort of, there's become equity in ball striking.
Yeah. But I did, I mean, my friend Mike Clayton, who you know, mm-hmm. His theory is that if you can't hit a three iron, you shouldn't be a pro.
I'm with you.
You know,
it makes me ill. Just
it's looking, a little bit severe.
Look in somebody's golf bag and the longest iron is six or five iron. Ugh, yuck.
I know.
Can't stand it.
Do you think it would it be interesting? What do you think would happen if the women had a tournament where the hybrids weren't allowed? What would
Carrie Webb would win?
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, how who are the, you know, I've kind of touched on this already, but the best players, I mean, we touched Lopez and that group of Americans, but who, Annika and Webb came along and they were the best two players for quite a period.
Just slightly after pushed that. Each other.
Who's the best one you've ever seen in your, just actually seen live? And why?
No question, Mickey Wright.
Right.
Yeah. When they had the old Centel Classic in Tallahassee, I was in contention on Saturday and Sunday, and I got up early both days to go watch her play, just so I could hear the sound of the strike. Yeah. And it was still that good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everyone says that. I mean, yeah. I think Peter Costas told me once, he went out and watched that time, and he said, well, he...
Amazing.
Take a lot to impress somebody.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. And she could barely walk. Her feet were so bad.
Right.
But just to watch the ball flight and watch her stand at address.
If all our golf talk has you itching for a round, then make sure you check out Golf Now. The Golf Now app and website gives you an easy way to book social golf online at hundreds of courses across Australia, including some of Golf Australia's top 100 tracks. No queues, no call waiting, just the tee times you want at your fingertips 24/7. Download the free app or visit golfnow.com.au today. Go play.
I tell you one thing that's changed, and this is a slightly controversial subject, is that back in the day, I mean, there was all these murmurings about sexuality on the LPGA Tour. And it seems like, happily, that is a complete non-factor anymore. I never read about it, hear about it. No one seems to care, as they shouldn't care.
They don't care.
But back in the day, it was. I mean, how...
There was always murmurings about it, and yeah. I was out there to play golf.
Yeah.
And that was it, and leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an irrelevance, or should be. And it seems to me that we're almost there, I think, on that subject. Yeah, so. How much time did you spend watching the men? I mean, you've probably watched a lot more of the men since you stopped playing, but how aware were you of the men's game when you were...
Very, very much so.
And how much did you think, oh, I want to be Seve pitching? For example,
Seve pitching.
The men all stopped to watch Seve pitch, so the women.
Of course, yeah. As a youngster, I drove a solid 2.5 hours each direction to watch Seve. Ended up because a thunderstorm rolled in to watch him hit about 20 golf shots.
Right.
And working with Azinger on my bunker game in the early 90s, I mean, he was telling stories about how he watched Seve hit and copied a lot of what Seve did. So I definitely. I watched a lot of guys play on television. I watched a lot of live golf. I would go to Bay Hill.
You're a bit of a geek, basically.
I am totally a geek.
Yeah.
And just listen and watch. Yeah. You don't even have to ask any questions. Yeah. Just be a sponge and pick up on whether it's a pre-shot routine or how they practice it, the drills they do, or all of that. And just absorb it. Mm-hmm.
It's always amazing that, I mean, the Seve thing was always funny when he was on the European Tour and he would wander off to the pitching area and it was an amazing number of guys would suddenly just watch.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? I mean, it's an amazing thing, even at the highest level, that you can still set yourself apart.
Yeah.
The true genius is still, you know, has got an edge.
When I was playing on tour in the weeks that Joanne Carner came out and played, you'd see a little bit of the same thing because she was such a great bunker player. She had great dexterity in her hands, but she had a flair and it wasn't cookie cutter. You'd end up with four or five players standing around the bunker watching her hit bunker shots.
Yeah. And counting the cigarette butts.
Well, and you knew they were hers because they had either bright pink or bright red lipstick on the end of them.
Yeah. She was quite a character.
She was still the best. I remember she got on this sort of fitness kick, And the LPGA didn't have any money for, in the fitness trailer to use this piece of machinery she'd been using all winter long. So she bought one and had it put in the trailer so everybody could use it. Yeah. And she came strolling up out of the locker room at the LPGA championship when we were at DuPont, and she had a vodka in one hand and her cigarette in the other, and she was going up to use this piece of machinery. So she just set both of them on the lower step, and she continued up the steps to the fitness trailer, and we knew Joanne was in there.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
It always reminds me of Russell Clayton, who was a, European tour player, mm-hmm. and slightly heavier than most people. And he was once asked if he'd ever been in the fitness trailer. And he goes, yeah, of course. He says, I've been there all the time. He says, because there's television, I can watch the football.
Exactly.
So there's a reason.
Very,
for that,
very similar. Yeah.
I want you to talk to you about the Solheim Cup. Mm-hmm. Your relationship with the Solheim Cup has changed a fair bit over the years. Mm-hmm. How important was something like that coming along? Because the Ryder Cup is hugely, it's the biggest thing outside the majors.
Right.
And the Solheim Cup doesn't quite get the same level of attention even now, but it's terrific entertainment to watch.
And it's become very well matched.
What was it like to play?
Well, I'll set this.
The beginning, it wasn't much of a match. Let's be
it
the
wasn't.
First one.
It wasn't.
But then you lost the second one.
Lost the second one in 92, but to go back even deeper, my passion for the Solheim Cup was undoubtedly because the Americans took the Curtis Cup that I played on in 86.
Which you lost.
So much for granted.
Yeah.
Which we lost. And lost pretty solidly at a place that we should have won. Mm-hmm. So when it came time to be a part of that first Solheim Cup, and I was the last player onto the American team by qualification. Everybody knew Lopez was going to get the pick.
Yeah.
Because she was a legend. B, you have to have familiarity for people to latch onto with a new event.
Yeah.
It was important for me to somewhat avenge that loss. And I remember having the American flag come down at Prairie Dunes and the Curtis Cup saying, I will never be on a team that takes something for granted.
Yeah, I have this image of this pissed off dog.
I was
Pepper.
Pissed. So, yeah. I was pissed and humiliated.
Yeah.
And I just vowed that would never be.
It was unusual to lose the Curtis Cup.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah. So I remember. Yeah.
All rookies on the team. And I don't think anybody gave the history of the matches. So, sitting here where we are, the match before that was played at Muirfield,
that's right, yeah.
And you walk into Grey Walls now, and there's that team that I was trying to make for the very first time.
Yeah.
And then, we had a team that I think took it for granted.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary place for them to go.
Mm-hmm.
At that
and twice.
Time. And they went to St. George's in 88,
mm-hmm.
which was just as bad.
No.
I could never quite get my head around.
And that's what, when people said how bad Muirfield was, as far as being accepting of women. And then you reminded them that there were two Curtis Cup that were played there. There were?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were.
Yeah. Very controversial Curtis Cup that in 84. Mm-hmm. No Scots in the team.
Now that, you're right.
Very controversial.
Only because I had to sit with David now that you say that.
Yeah.
And we had where were we? It was on the West Coast this year. We had to sit, and it was for a thing that he was doing at Muirfield to make sure we had all the players properly identified. And we had, and I got 90% of them, but there were a few that I had to go back.
On the 84 team?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I could probably name most of them, but
yeah.
So what were the highlights for you and lowlights of your Solheim Cup times?
Highlight?
Do you still celebrate that putt that Laura Davis missed that I've given you a hard time about before?
No.
You're the,
no. But I will go down to the end. And Brandi Burton will tell you this too, that I didn't say, yes, she missed the putt. I said, yes, we're still in the match, because I think we would have gone three down in a heartbeat.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I witnessed that. I was standing by the green. And I was appalled by this behavior.
Highlight was one of two. Making the first team. For sure. But going undefeated at Muirfield Village.
Yeah.
In 98 was really, it was important. My family was there. It was Judy's second time. It was a golf course that I believe raised the Solheim Cups the way the event was looked at, because you're playing at a place where that was so important in European Ryder Cup.
Well, plus it was important that it was competitive.
Correct.
You know, because if it had just been like the President's Cup is,
that's right.
It could have, you know,
96. It really was quickly. Extremely competitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, Americans had to come from behind to win that's on right. Sunday. So it was an event that had been blown up because of the Ryder Cup. It had been elevated because of Nicklaus. It was because of the golf course having some significance. It was an important week. And Ohio State was in town playing football on Sunday, right. or a Saturday, and we went toe-to-toe with how many people came out to watch women's golf. That was pretty – it was an important event.
Judy Rankin did this podcast a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Judy's image now is this sweet little old lady type, you know,
no, sir.
I know better, obviously, yeah. And I got hints of it came out, you know, when talking about the Solheim Cup. I
mean, definitely. Yeah, so. She got in her team's grill when she thought they were getting a little whiny. And it was exactly intense. How she was.
Yeah.
Yippee was intense, her husband, when he was still with us. And I think it was really cool that I got to see them together, staying in the house with them at Muirfield Village.
Right.
So it was Brandy, myself, Judy, and Yippee. And I still laugh when I go by that house on the first hole at Muirfield Village, because it was filled with such great memories. Low lights. There were definitely a few. Played really poorly in 92.
At Delmahoy.
At Delmahoy, played terribly. Got really sick afterward. In fact, didn't even go to Japan to try to lock up the Vare Trophy. I had to kind of hope I had played well enough.
Right.
Ended up coming out of here with a double ear infection and was down for the count for a long time. But just played poorly. Yeah. And there wasn't a whole lot of cohesiveness. Yeah,
my memory of that, I was living in America at the time, so I wasn't there. But memory of that, was it Beth Daniel?
With Beth Daniel.
Said the, you know... Neumann would be the only one.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah. So Kathy Whitworth's mom died that week. Whit went home. So there was turmoil there and not a lot of leadership. And one of the things she did say at the beginning of the week, I don't want any of you reading the newspapers. And Beth goes in and runs her mouth. And that was the headline.
Yeah, what
and
she actually said was...
That was fodder for the wall in the locker room, and that was all that was needed.
Yeah. Lori Neumann was the only member of their team that
would make the American team, and that was all that was necessary to just put. But I think, too, the Women's European Tour were in a state that they knew that event was super important. And there were financial struggles. Yeah. There was an unknown about their future. Yeah. Absolutely. So it became... That became even more important of an event. And I think there was a little bit of attitude amongst the Americans, similar to at Prairie Dunes and the Curtis Cup, that it was just a four. It was almost an assumption that there was going to be an American victory. So when it went to Greenbrier in 94, it was a different attention that was paid.
On the subject of the Women's European Tour, I mean, Laura Davis deserves, I know, you can't give her enough credit, because she basically kept that thing alive.
No question.
I'm sure she was being paid, you know, whatever, to be there. But if she hadn't gone, it was dead in the water. And the fact that she was the high-profile name that the papers could latch onto and whatever, it wouldn't exist today if it wasn't for her. No,
it would not have.
I've said that to her. She's the only person I know who saved a tour.
Yeah. And continues to play.
Yeah.
And played all around the world.
I mean, she's not quite competitive at the top level now, and she would tell you that herself, but people still want to watch her play.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. She could do things with a golf ball that most women could not.
Yeah. You could argue that she's been the most important figure in golf, women's golf, not so much in America, but
worldwide,
just about everywhere else. You know,
it would be tough to come up with another name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's getting into your business now.
I know, and she's darn good at it.
Exactly.
She's darn good at it.
So tell me how your evolution from playing into the broadcasting side of it came, because Judy Rankin, who we mentioned, was important, I know.
She was it for me.
Yeah.
She, not that she paved the way, but she gave me a nudge, talked to a couple of the right people who said, you know, I think she might be okay at this.
Had you thought about it before?
I did.
Yeah.
I did, and I remember doing a sit down with her at one of those old Wendy's three tour challenge. You know, they do the fireside chat where they come in with four or five questions that are pretty similar for all of the players. And she said, well, when you're done playing, what do you see yourself doing? And I said, I want your job. And we still laugh now. She said, because you got my job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when I signed with CBS, she said, you're doing something I've never done. She goes, you're actually going to get to call the Masters. She said, let's go on vacation.
Right.
So she's become, well, she's a mentor in lots of ways. She started working in television, the first women's open that I played in, U.S. Women's Open in 84. And she was so terrified that she was said, I didn't think anything was going to come out when they put the microphone in my hand and I had to call a shot. She was absolutely terrified. But that was my first Women's Open, was her first as a broadcaster.
Right.
Yeah. So, like train tracks.
Right.
And
as part of the media now, if you like, I mean, how do you look back on the Dottie Pepper player in your interactions with the media? Because I can remember interviewing you once, and you didn't know who I was at the time. And we sat down, and you were very cagey because you didn't know.
Yeah, sure.
There was no trust level there at that point. But how were you? How would you sum it up?
I think I was really impacted by that they made you do rookie orientation. Immediate training was part of it. And from the very get-go, you learn that nothing's off the record and don't necessarily trust any member of the media.
Yeah.
So I think maybe I probably took that a little too steeply, but yeah, I didn't necessarily trust. But I also, we were talking earlier today about classes you took, whether it was in English or whatever it was, you learned the power of the quote. And I just think that a lot of journalists abuse the power of the quote. And I tend to choose my words pretty purposefully, so when someone doesn't get that part,
so I'm not
going
to be able to catch you out here, am I?
I'm going to try to say no. Yeah. And it was one of the great lessons early on in broadcasting was from the producer at NBC, Tommy Roy, who's multi-Emmy winning and done everything there is really to cover in golf.
But broadcasting and journalism are different.
Are definitely different, but the similarity, I believe, is that Tommy always said to run whatever you're going to say, to have a forward look, run it through a quick filter, and then say it. And I think sometimes there are parallels there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easy to get into trouble. I mean, God knows I've written in.
Hey, I've gotten myself in a whole bunch of trouble.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Yeah. How do you look back? There was a hot mic, as they say. The mic was on and you didn't realize it was
correct.
On.
We were told we were in break and I called them choking freaking dogs.
Yeah.
They were definitely going down that road.
This is the American Solheim Cup
team. The American Solheim Cup team in 2007.
Right.
And
but that's cost you, hasn't it? Because you would have been a captain, I have to believe.
I probably would have been a captain. There are still a couple of players that don't really acknowledge my existence, which I think is just silly.
Yeah.
And a couple of them have now since gotten into television and have said, that television thing's a lot harder than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Even from a timing, from a delivery, from a homework work perspective. So I guess in some ways, I mean, you have to let it go. Mm-hmm. I didn't hide from it. You can't hide from it.
Who doesn't speak to you? Are you going to tell me?
Sherry Steinhauer.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Named first at the top of the list. And it took a while for Laura Diaz and I to...
Right.
To come back to being on the same page. And in fact, we're on the list of assistant captains for Meg together in 2013, 10 years ago.
Yeah. So what's your kind of philosophy on broadcasting? What are you trying to achieve and how do you try and achieve that?
I believe good broadcasting is less is more. As Mike McQuaid from ESPN always would say, economy of words. Mm. And I think that's even more valuable now because people have a lot of things at their disposal and a lot of them have those things at their disposal when they're watching television.
Right.
So don't tell me the obvious. Mm-hmm. But tell me something I wouldn't don't otherwise
tell me what
I've
know. Just seen either.
Right. Yeah. Don't make it. Tell me something I don't know in as few words as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's always
additive is the word.
It's interesting you say that because one of the, I mean, it's criticism is too strong a word, but American television is different from the mm-hmm. TV over here. Mm-hmm. The commentators, broadcasters, even on course people they get more time mm-hmm. over here.
Mm-hmm.
You're in and out. I mean, it's got to be.
Criticism has come a lot from social media. knowing that the other platforms are showing more shots, the business model behind our shot is that we have to, you know, you want to show as much golf as you can.
Yeah.
I think our commercial breaks are longer.
Oh, it's unwatchable.
At times. Yeah. And we've gotten a lot better at it. If you look at the number of shots we show.
Yeah.
So you can't, you kind of can't have it both ways, especially if you get a compacted leaderboard.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost no time for storytelling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I lived in the States, left in 96. And even before then, I would tape the golf and zap through and watch a 2-hour telecast in 45 minutes. Something like that. You know,
yeah, it does.
Exaggeration.
So, I think the load is typically for every 1 hour, there's 21 minutes or 22 minutes
mm-hmm.
of true commercial time. Now, they've cut that because of the playing throughs or the eye on the course or whatever your company's branded on. So there is more golf now. But I think what we're sensitive to in television is that it's expensive to do what we do.
Mm.
There are a lot of people.
Somebody has to pay for it. Yeah.
Somebody has to pay for it.
It's the same with magazines. It's
advertising. It ads for ads. Yeah. So there is a balance, and I think we're getting a little better at it. But at the sometimes the cost of that is there's not as much storytelling.
There's definitely a line where people are going to start switching off.
Yeah.
Because it's too much.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And you know that's just a fact of life.
No question.
Yeah.
So I think if you want to watch nothing but shots. Then you have to go to another platform. And even those aren't cheap, and they're putting ads through too. At the beginning when you tune on, if you're trying to stream, you're going to get hit with 2 or 3 minutes.
It seems to me that you're on course most of the time
mm-hmm.
doing what you do. Is that the most fun, or what is the most fun if that isn't?
I'm an outdoor dog.
Yeah, up close.
Yeah.
You must be great. You've seen things. David Fertig used to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, it was especially with Tiger. I mean, he got to see Tiger, you know, at the top of his game.
Correct.
I mean, right there. I mean, you've got a very privileged position.
I have it, and I know I do. Mm-hmm. I think I have. Jim Nance will say he has the best seat in golf, and I would say I've got the best stance in golf. I'm literally standing there, witness to a lot of things that don't happen when we're, you know, that happen when we're not on camera.
Yeah.
Conversations that the players will have with me, or caddy mm-hmm. will have, or just to drop a nugget here. I have the best spot, I think.
What would be your highlight?
And just there for final moments. But some of the Ryder Cups were fantastic. And the Ryder Cup at Valhalla was my first in America. I did the K Club first, and then Valhalla was my second. And I was supposed to be in Bob Murphy's Outer Tower to start Friday morning. So I had prepared all of this as the matches are coming through. So you're going to have a little nugget or two on the players, and I get a call from Tommy Roy again on Thursday night, and he said, "Dot, do you really want to be in Murph's Tower tomorrow?" And I said, "Honestly, no." Mm. I said, I'd rather be on the golf course." He says, "Good, because I'm putting you out with match two."
There you go.
And I was thrilled because I wanted to feel it.
Yeah, but plus it doesn't really matter which match in the Ryder Cup because that's the one time where every game means the same.
Absolutely.
It's not stroke play.
No, it's 1 point.
Yeah.
You're fighting over that. There's not a score attached to it. And I remember that same week, I think it might have been after this, it was a Saturday afternoon session, standing behind the 18th green, and Poulter came off and his eyes were enormous. He just hold another, but wasn't Medina. It was at Valhalla.
Yeah.
But his eyes, and I thought, oh, crap, that's what I used to look like.
Well, honey,
that was it.
That was my next question. Who's the one that reminds you most
Poulter
of you?
Poulter, without question. Yeah. It was. I loved being on the ground doing that. But, you know, I gotten the chance to be out. One of the most memorable ones, and it wasn't even a guy, it wasn't winning, was Tiger at Belrive. That last PGA there when he had, you know, he couldn't hit it on the planet.
No.
I think he hit one fairway on Sunday for the first nine holes.
Place,
My legs were tired. But to be as you felt the swell. The 2020 Masters, I'll never forget because it was so different.
Mm-hmm.
And
Masters is different, full stop.
It's full stop.
Because you don't get to walk on the fairways there. I mean, how does that? You know,
and I'm inside the ropes now completely. I have full access to go wherever I want at the Masters.
Augusta.
At Augusta.
Really? I didn't know that.
Starting in 2020.
Ah.
So I remember coming up. out of the bowl at 13, cutting across the 14th fairway to because of the weather stoppage. I was supposed to go with Dustin Johnson all day long, but ended up starting with Tiger. And he said to me, "Wait, what are you doing here?" I said, "It's so 2020, isn't it?"
Yeah.
Because everything was just different. Things were done differently. And he just started laughing. He goes, "Yep, very 2020. So I've been inside the ropes as the only person on the ground since November of 20. Yeah. So 20. So this was my fourth one on the ground.
Right. What do you make of Tiger?
He's an enigma. You can't figure the guy out. But he, at his core, he loves to be needled. And I think he appreciates people treating him as a normal person. Mm-hmm. Because so few people did or do.
Yeah.
You know, he was always a trust thing. And if you could talk to him about things that were really normal, open up in a second.
I wouldn't want his life
to not be able to pull through a McDonald's or go fill up your car with gas or anything. Like that. No. But at the U.S. Open at Bethpage, where Lucas Glover won in 9, was assigned to Tiger early on, and he'd come back from another knee injury. And I remember walking up the third or fourth hole to him, up to the first par 3, so it must have been after the second or third hole. And I said, "You know, I don't understand you." And he stopped right away. I said, "My dog jumped off the back porch, and 6 weeks later, her knee was good." He said, "It took you 6 months?" Chatted about the whole thing for the rest of the day. So it was a disarming, trusty thing where he felt comfortable. And that
he's never been that way with anybody in the media.
No, if you have something that's a commonality, we would talk about skiing because he liked to ski. Dogs are really big, and his kids. I had to do a walk in or a post-run interview with him when he's taking out his phone and he got a text message and he says, another game. A girl didn't score again, but she played however many minutes in a soccer match. Right. So he's. Loves his kids, loves his dogs, and loves to be treated as a normal human being.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly mellowed a bit. Yeah, when he was unplayable for us for a long time.
Just distrust.
Yeah, he just wouldn't answer questions or even innocuous questions.
He was very good at saying a lot with nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I always used to laugh at people at the Open say you'd have guys who didn't really do golf very often, and you'd get the notebook out and they'd running into Tiger, and you'd see them like this, and then they'd walk out and they'd
didn't say anything.
Nothing.
No.
You know, he was very frustrating at that point.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And I think he could have given a lot more, and I say a lot more, without hurting himself.
I think in the way that he
thought he might.
Yeah.
He was a long way from the red line, if you like, in terms of what he said.
Just think he always thought people were trying to take advantage of them, and it was very distrusting. Yeah. But if you'd kind of proven that you weren't in it just for you and were genuine about caring about him as a human being, it was different. Mm. Or would just give it back to him, because people just didn't do that.
No, it's true. Yeah. He always kind of way back in the day. I used to ghost Mark O'Meara's stuff at Digest, and Woods used to refer to me as O'Meara's pal. But that was a long time ago. I don't know if he knows who I am now. And I don't think he knows. I think he probably knows who everybody is. He knows
everything.
Yeah, and reads more than he lets
on. Reads and watches more than he lets on.
Yeah, yeah. It was just interesting.
Yeah.
Has there been a, for golf, I always think if Tiger coming along, he was the most famous sportsman on the planet.
Yes.
For quite a long time, and maybe still is. Yeah,
but Tiger and Michael Jordan?
Yeah. That's right. But golf hasn't made it out of the niche. I'm not sure it ever will now, because Tiger, if it wasn't going to do it with Tiger, leading the way, it's never going to happen. You know, it'll be a long, long time before another golfer is the most famous sportsman in the world.
Correct.
It might happen, but it'll be a long time.
Here's my sadness about where we are in the world of golf right now, of professional golf. These guys think they should be paid like they are that face, and they're not.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
And that's where I think we've kind of gotten off the rails.
Yeah, the money's out of control.
It's not sustainable.
No, that's right.
It's not. And I think that's where we got in trouble.
I think this is going to be my last question, but with the way that everything is at the moment, it's certainly in the men's game, I'm not going to ask you what you think is going to happen. I'm going to ask you what you would like to see happen. What's the end game in this for you? What would be the best result?
I don't know that I've really gotten there yet. I was talking to a friend yesterday, and they talk about the kind of the five levels of grief and the kind of things you go through. Mm-hmm. And I started out being definitely in denial, because I can't believe we've gone down this path.
Yeah.
And then you get angry, and I've been totally ticked off about all of this, partly because I think some of the inevitability of what's going to happen, because frankly, it's taken a lot of energy out of a lot of people, and it's splintered friendships.
It's like Trump did the same. You know, people stop talking about politics.
I know. and also just the collateral damage of people's families. Just not being able to talk to each other, but just the wear and tear. People that were now left sort of, you know, in control or supposed to be responsible for what's happening today, that a month ago wasn't their job, and the stress on their families. Nobody thinks about that.
No, that's true.
And then you make a bargain with yourself. Well, if we do this, then maybe that'll happen.
Well, my hope is that we'll come out of this better than we were before. I mean, I think this is a view shared by a lot of people who are not American, and I never have been a huge fan of the PGA Tour. Not as a, yes, as a product, and as a, you know, as an entertainment, great players and all the rest of it. But there was a sameness to it, and I think they went about their business, and maybe you can argue that's fair enough, and paid no attention to what was going on around the world, and they basically slaughtered the Australian Tour. It doesn't really exist anymore because the players, the top Australian players, don't get the opportunity to go back.
Well, the wraparound season was a huge mistake.
Exactly, yeah. I mean,
if that hadn't happened, I think the golf world would have been a more cohesive place.
Yeah.
The wraparound season was a disaster.
I mean, we all want to see a worldwide circuit.
Of course, everybody wants to play the women against have basically the done best. That. Correct.
Yeah.
The women's tour, when Norman started on this big rant 30 years ago, the women's tour was the world tour.
Yeah.
And there was support, and there was, you got some of the best players to play come out of Japan. Korea was just starting to turn out really good players. Europe was turning out really good players, and they did play on that stage. Mm-hmm. And that's what everybody was looking for. The wraparound season was a disaster.
Yeah.
And they're finally now acknowledging it because there wasn't an opportunity for players to go home.
America's not interested.
Correct. Yeah,
they're watching the NFL.
Exactly. It was a huge, huge mistake.
Yeah.
And I think that was the beginning of the divisiveness and the PGA Tour only looking out for the PGA Tour and not looking out for golf in general.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I think that now they have to.
Yeah. Well, as I say, this could be
maybe it could actually
the biggest
turn
opportunity
out better.
Ever.
I think so. And I do think it's important to recognize that there is a difference, again, between professional golf and all of golf.
I mean, if professional golf means an old line, if it disappeared tomorrow, it wouldn't make any difference.
It wouldn't.
Saturday morning, the golf club down the road would still be full.
Absolutely. And I think that's, again, where these guys have gotten off the rails, demanding all this mainstream sport money when it's not mainstream. It's still happily it's a prodigious niche.
Yeah, that's right. I tell you what was nice this week, we're here at North Berwick, and you see guys like Spieth and Thomas going out to play
a course
and just behaving like kids.
Loving it.
Yeah.
Loving it.
I wish there was more of
that. Where did we lose that?
Stop behaving like businessmen. Get rid of your agent.
Go play golf.
And just play. Yeah, exactly. Get back to being like you were as a kid.
Absolutely. Everybody talks about, you know, they go through a poor stretch of putting, and what are you trying to do? Go back and putt like a kid. Go play like a kid.
Exactly.
Yeah. And add it up at the end of the day, and everything's going to be just fine.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Dottie.
It's been
a pleasure.
It's
always fun to talk, and thanks for doing it.
Some terrific stuff there from one of the best in the business, and a big thanks to Dottie Pepper for taking the time to sit and chat with John Huggan. Well, that's it for episode 99, but we will be back again in 2 weeks' time. Catch us then, here on The Thing About Golf.